Hi, everyone. Welcome back to The Common Good. My name is Ian Simpkins, along with Brian Fromm. And finally back to the show. We had such a good time last time that we just couldn't wait to get him back on the show. David Koizis, welcome back to the show, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you back. Would you just take a moment or two and just remind our audience who you are, what you're about, what do you do, what are you passionate about?
Certainly. I am an academic political scientist, retired. I'm a global scholar with an organization called Global Scholars Canada. I have a PhD in government and international studies from the University of Notre Dame. I taught undergraduate political science for 30 years. And I am the author of two books, We Answer to Another, Authority, Office, and the Image of God. And that was published in 2014. And then my most recent book, which was also my first book, is now in a second edition, is Political Visions and Illusions, which came out just last year.
Oh, that's outstanding. David, I'm curious, as a political scientist and someone who's, you know, given their life to the study of politics, as you watch the American election going on here, this election season, do you love this time or are you disheartened by what's going on? How do you feel right now, 2 weeks before our election?
I'm uneasy. I guess I could put it that way. I'm not without hope, but I am uneasy. It seems in many ways as though the American polity is very much divided. People distrust each other. People are seem to regard anything they don't like as fake news. I don't know that there's a lot of instances of people sitting down with each other, talking out their differences, which is what politics really ought to be about.
One of the things we talked about real briefly at the beginning of the hour was the news that for the next debate, there will be mic muting. And Brian and I, we're not political scientists. We barely know how we got a show in the first place. more than just like, do you like it or not like it, which tends to be what Facebook and Twitter is. I'd love to know, is there a deeper significance to that shift in a debate forum for a moderator to have the power of a mute button? I just love to know what you think of that.
I think it's past due. I think they should have done that for the first debate. I sat there, I watched it, and I thought, why don't they just cut out the mic? They've gone past their time. Their interruptions just shut down the mic. I have no difficulty with that, especially right now in this election.
Yeah. I'm curious, without getting into, you know, who you're voting for or support, I'm just curious, as a political scientist and someone who's watched kind of the larger arc, did it surprise you either in 2016 or even now in 2020 that somebody like Donald Trump, who wasn't a politician or whatever else, was able to come up to the presidency? Did you see that coming, or did that totally take you off guard?
It did not take me off guard, because for the last 50 years, ever since the political parties made their internal reforms after the 1968 election, a disaster was waiting to happen. So basically, prior to that time, candidates for public office were generally chosen in the proverbial smoke-filled rooms. And of course, everybody uses that term, smoke-filled rooms, in a pejorative sense. But it served a function, because this, in the smoke-filled rooms, you'd have genuine officials, public officials, office holders who were members of the party, vetting possible candidates for approval. And I think it's possible to excessively democratize a political system, which in many respects I think is what has happened in the United States over the last half a century. Simply submitting a candidate, let me put it this way, a candidate submitting him or herself to the people during the primary elections without any kind of pre-selection process, without any kind of a vetting process by the people who know that candidate best, I think that's a recipe for disaster. I would much prefer to see something along the lines of the old smoke-filled rooms. Maybe now they would have no smoking signs. I think that's a possibility. But whatever they're smoking or eating or doing whatever in those rooms, somebody needs to sit down and actually vet candidates. To examine their record, to see whether they really are qualified for the office which they are seeking. So, you know, if you get a job with a major corporation, such as IBM or Exxon or ExxonMobil, you're going to submit to interviews. They're going to want to know your qualifications. It's now possible for somebody to make the highest public office in the land to attain that office without any kind of pre-clearance or interview stage at all by people who are in the know. And I don't think that's good for a political system.
One of the things that Brian and I have talked a lot about this last year in particular as pastors is just seeing the rampant division we've seen, particularly online. You know, we've pontificated as to why that is. Is it actually worse than it was 10 years ago? Or is it just more visual? And one of the things that you mentioned on your blog, Byzantine Calvinist, which is a great title, by the way, just yesterday was this study by More in Common regarding the perception gap. And Brian, yes, and I have actually referenced that study a couple of times, but I would yes, love to get your take on that.
Yeah, I've not read the whole thing. I've just read the highlights, but I think it's rather extraordinary the number of people who the number of people who have friends only within their particular political opinions. And I think that's very unhealthy. I think it's better that we have friends that represent different political points of view, and to nurture those friendships and to recognize that politics isn't everything, and that politics should not be determining friendships, because friendship is something that's distinctive. It's something that's been celebrated since the time of Aristotle, since the time of ancient Israel as well. And a friendship is a friendship, and it ought not to be confused with a political comradeship, if you will.
Is that a newer phenomenon? Is that something that's growing more through social media and other things? Or has that always been the way we've been culturally?
Well, I think people do tend to choose friends who are like themselves and with whom they share basic commitments about life. And I think there's nothing unusual about that. But I do think that with the rise of social media, we have this illusion that we now create the communities around us, and that we can choose who's going to be part of that community. And we are in the very center of that community. And that's it's narcissistic. It's not really what friendship is all about, because friendship is about mutual giving to each other. And that kind of friendship, I'm afraid, is rare these days, especially among males. That's my sense. Maybe among females you find that sort of friendship today, but I think among males, the sort of friendship that might cross political lines, but there's a genuine affection that's holding the friends together. That's something that we need to nurture. And I don't think political polarization is helping us with that respect. And I don't think social media are helping us either.
One of the things I actually remember from this study was just how bad both sides were at perceiving the values and views of the other. Like, it seemed to be pretty even both ways, which, you know, to me leads to all sorts of other implications. But we only have about a minute left in this segment. I'd love to know, just in line with what you just said, do you have like maybe one or two practical suggestions for maybe even baby steps towards building or cultivating friendships with people, you know, who might be quote unquote outside your tribe?
Get to know the people who are around you. Get to know the people in your neighborhood. And that's not easy to do, because neighborhoods are not quite as, there's not as much, friendship growing out of neighborliness as there used to be. But I think it's, don't simply look within your political, network or social network, but try to go outside of that in some fashion. And very often families help us with that, because, you know, our children marry people whom we don't necessarily know, and we have to learn to love people who are from different families, but now are now related to us as in-laws in some way. And I think you're going to find that more likely within a larger family rather than a smaller family.
Yeah.
That's great. That other voice you're hearing, by the way, is Dr. David Koizis. He's the author of a new book called Political Visions and Delusions. And that's a great segue, by the way, because coming up next, I want to ask you a little bit more about this notion of politics in the family, and with the holidays around the corner, how can we actually navigate that well? That's coming up next year on The Common Good on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to The Common Good. My name is Ian Simpkins, along with Brian Fromm, and we're joined for a second segment by David Koizis. He is the author of Political Visions and Delusions, and an educator and an all-around swell guy. And David, I think you just have such a unique perspective and wisdom with regards to this political climate that we find ourselves in. And one of the things that I keep hearing people talk about with the holidays around the corner is, hey, if you go home or if you're around family members, just don't bring up politics, whatever you do. And my sense has always been, oh, man, if we can't talk about politics with our family, what hope do we have to engage in these conversations with our communities or our churches? What is your sense there with regards to how we navigate political discussions within our families?
Right. Well, I don't really have any, clear advice on that, but I do think that that it would be nice that in family settings, if we were actually to be able to sit down and discuss our differences, you know, not only within family settings, but maybe with our neighbors, maybe with friends as well. It's not particularly easy to do, and of course, it's interesting that I went when I was growing up. I always used to hear that at parties, don't mention religion and politics, because those are two divisive subjects and you're supposed to avoid them. And what do? I go around and I turn right around in my youth and I start studying religion and politics, which may go some way in explaining why I'm invited to so very few parties these days. I think it would be good if we could sit down within our families and talk these things out. It isn't always easy to do, because very often we think that we have our minds set. We think that we are that our opinions are set in stone, and we prefer not to have to listen to people on the other side. Right. But I think it is true. If we can't do it in our families, then how can we do it in a larger political community? And that's, of course, what we ought to be doing.
Yeah. And likewise with churches, Ian and I are both pastors. I'm wondering, what would your advice and your counsel be to pastors and church leaders about how to navigate and help their churches, the people within their churches, be able to have political discussions without it fracturing and tearing them apart as well?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because I know of pastors who have been run out of their churches because they started pronouncing on politics, and you have to handle it very carefully, because I think if somebody stands in the pulpit and says, you know, you our congregation, if you're going to be real Christians, you have to support the $15 per hour minimum wage. That's too much. There's no way that a minister or even an ecclesiastical assembly ought to be pronouncing on something like that. On the other hand, there are many, many passages in the Bible which instruct us to do justice, especially to those who are most vulnerable. And in the Old Testament in particular, there are three groups that are singled out: the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. And these are people that are the most vulnerable. The sojourner is not part of the land tenure system. They are immigrants, if you will. A widow may be in a vulnerable position when her husband dies. An orphan is probably the most helpless at all, because he or she is still an immature child. And that's something which ministers and ecclesiastical assemblies ought to tell the parishioners in the pews. You need to look out for justice. You need to do justice. You need to, as a citizen, you need to be sure that you are monitoring the larger body politic to make sure that justice is done. And if it's not being done, then you need to work to secure justice, especially for those who are most vulnerable.
That's a good word. I'm curious how you would respond to some of what we've seen, which Brian and I will often, you know, talk about, like as the cross and the flag holding hands. You know, we've seen clips of church services. I saw one just yesterday of a hymn being sung, and there was a whole team of people dancing with American flags behind them while they sang it. And I'm really fascinated to know your perspective on the union between church and state, and how can churches engage in political discourse without necessarily like trying to baptize the country as a whole. How do you navigate those discussions?
Right, right. To be honest, when I see those kinds of things that you're talking about, those kinds of pageants or displays or what have you, it makes my skin crawl. It's not something that I'm terribly keen on, because I think there is a real risk of idolatry in that respect. Now we have every right to love our respective countries, to love our respective homelands. You know, God has placed us in a particular country, in a particular homeland, and we ought to work to improve that homeland in the best we can, in the best way that we can. And I think that's what we ought to be doing. We can become teary-eyed when we think of our country. There's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with waving the flag either at the appropriate occasions. I'm not very keen on seeing national flags inside church sanctuaries, or even in the foyer outside the church itself. But I think there is a place for a certain modest kind of flag waving. Not that my country is the best in the world. You might think it's the best because it's your country, but other people think that their countries are the best because they grew up there. It's their homeland. And I think we need to recognize that.
Yeah. I'm curious, as a political scientist, I'm wondering, there's been a lot of talk I've seen on Twitter and other places about the Electoral College versus changing the way we do elections just to popular vote. Curious where you stand on that, and maybe help us understand maybe the pros and cons of one versus the other there.
Yes. Well, the Electoral College was established in 1787, at the time that the Constitution was being negotiated by the American founders. And their intention was that the electors would gather together or vote wherever they are, and they would exercise their own independent initiative in deciding who was going to be president. So they never really envisioned that there would be a popular vote. As a matter of fact, James Madison would have preferred to see the Congress electing the president rather than this shadowy entity called the people electing the president. When the people elect a president, there's always the danger that the person who comes to office is going to be a Napoleonic figure who's going to promise to cut through red tape and to get things done. And of course, there's a danger in that respect of having a kind of a dictatorial figure. Now, on the other hand, you know, the Electoral College also was intended to empower the states as well as states. On the other hand, those who argue in favor of popular election, now there's something to be said for that. We all know that in 2016, Hillary Clinton had a larger popular vote total than the current president. And that happened in 2000 as well with George W. Bush and Al Gore. If there was to be adopted a popular vote, it would probably have to be a two-ballot vote, as they do in France. So if one candidate did not get the absolute majority, 50% plus one of the popular votes, then there would have to be a second round in which the top two vote-getters would stand a second time. Either that, or you could have a preferential ballot in which people would be ranking candidates, which amounts to basically the same thing.
That's right. That's right. Now, I know that we're going to go a little long here, but I just have so many other questions for you that I want to make sure to get your perspective on before we wrap up here. So,
yeah, sure.
You know, in just a minute or two left, I want to ask you kind of two questions. One, is the two-party system broken? Maybe a brief history of the two-party system, and is it broken? And secondly, how does that play into sort of the personality politics that we see right now?
Oh, yes, I believe it's broken. I tell people that the two major parties are diseased parodies of their former selves. I doubt very much that Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman would recognize today's Democratic Party. I doubt very much that somebody like Dwight Eisenhower or even Richard Nixon would recognize today's Republican Party. The extremists within those parties have come to the fore. It's not as though they differ with each other on basic principles, but they are. It's more like an intramural dispute. It's more like a dispute inside the family itself. And yes, I do think the party system is broken. And when the party system is broken, that means that spells a threat to the smooth functioning of the Constitution as a whole.
Hmm. Another voice you're hearing, by the way, is Dr. Koizus, who is not only an author and educator, he's written a couple of books. One's called Political Visions and Illusions, and before that, We Answer to Another. You can also learn more at ByzantineCalvinist.blogspot.com. Dr. Koizus, again, such a pleasure to have you on. Please, please, please come back on. We really love hearing your voice.
Oh, I would be very happy to do so. I'm really pleased to be here.
Well, that means a lot. Thank you so much for your time. You've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Home for your thoughts.